to Arthur Harris, Reel 1. I'd like to begin by asking you to tell me something about what sort of family you came from and about what sort of childhood you had.
Well, my father was one of what one might describe as a military family. All his brothers were in the army in India or in this country. But he was deaf, so he couldn't join the army, and he became an architect and engineer in the public works department in India. So I spent the first 3 or 4 years of my life in India, and then, like all children of those days and bringing up habits, I was dispatched back to this country for education. And the result was, of course, that like all Anglo-Indian children of military officers and Indian civil servants, my parents became virtually strangers to me. In fact, if I'd run into them at the age of 14 or 15 in the street, I wouldn't have known them. One was farmed out to various people who took children in the holidays from school, generally clergy folk, good, bad and indifferent, my experiences were. But on the whole, I was luckier than many. When I finished school, at the age of 17, my father had retired to this country, and asked me what I proposed to do, because he wanted me to go into the army, which was the very last thing I wanted to do. What relatives I ever met all seemed to be retired colonels, and I didn't want to be a retired colonel. I got rather overlaid by them. So in a rash moment he said, well, I'll send you any part of the world you want to go to and give you enough to live on until you can find what you want to do. So I said, I go to Rhodesia. Just drawing a bow at a venture.
What made you think of Rhodesia particularly?
Simply because an old boy at the school who was the lessee of the Comedy Theatre had given me a free ticket to the show. And the show was all about a Rhodesian planter who'd come back to England to marry his rather snooty fiancée, only to realise that she wouldn't fit into the Rhodesian scene. And he'd finished up by marrying a yeoman's daughter and living happily ever afterwards as a Rhodesian planter. And I'd read a bit about Rhodesia, the Rhodesia of those days. And I went out there and I never regretted it.
What sort of jobs did you turn your hand to in Rhodesia?
I turned my hand to any and every job that offered. In those days, one just didn't sit down waiting for a job with a large salary and a Jaguar motor car to be put into your lap. You either went and found a job or went hungry. So I found various jobs, running transport and contracting farm machinery and that sort of thing. And I finished up managing one of the biggest and best farms in Rhodesia while the owner was away for a year in England. And then the war broke out. So I cabled to the owner of the farm and said, you better come back because I've got to join the army like everybody else. I joined the 1st Rhodesian Regiment. And the delay waiting for my bus to come back and take over the farm left me with the choice of only 2 vacancies in the regiment, a machine gunner or a bugler. And as I couldn't convince the adjutant and the machine gun officer that I knew which was the spout of the gun and which was the other end, I said, well, all right, give me the bugle. And it just happened that I'd won the prize at the OTC camp as a bugler, so I did know what I was doing with that implement. And there, as you see, is the bugle.
What form did your very first military campaign take then in Rhodesia?
Well, on Christmas Day 1914, we landed at Walfish Bay, and from then on we marched. We went, we went round by sea again to Thwacket Mund and did a second landing there. And from then on we marched from one end of that country to the other, carrying everything we possessed, which was a generally empty water bottle, a nearly empty haversack with something to eat in it, but very little, 250 rounds of ammunition and a rifle. And I'd heard that march described afterwards by a British general as the greatest marching performance of a brigade, an infantry brigade, in the history of the British Army. I corrected him and pointed out it was the South African Rhodesian Army. But we outmarched the Boer commandos who were with us on horseback, and one realized the truth of the saying that a man can always, given equal conditions, outwalk a horse. The result was I never walked a yard since, if I could avoid it. And when that show was over and the Germans surrendered in the summer of 1915, together with about 300 or more other fellows from the regiment, we piled onto an 11-passenger ship, which was a little bit crowded, and came back to England to join up again.
What made you decide to join the Royal Flying Corps at that stage?
Well, I knew it was no good trying to get onto a horse because horses were out. Then I thought I might try to be a gunner and get a seat on a limber or a horse that way. But they seemed to be full up. And I went round to the War Office, where I was interviewed by a rather supercilious young man. And when I said I would like to fly, which I realized was something else I could do sitting down, not walking, he said, so would 6,000 other people. Would you like to be 6,001 on the waiting list? So I retired, rather disgruntled. And when I got back, my father just returned from India, having retired himself. And I told him what had happened. He said, oh, why didn't you go and see your Uncle Charlie? Well, he was just one of these many uncles. I didn't know who or where or what he was. But he gave me a note, and I went back to the War Office the next day. And when I handed the note to the same supercilious young fella, addressed to me, Uncle Charlie, he said, oh, please sit down a minute, sir, which was rather a change from his reception the day before. And he came back about 10 minutes later and he said, Colonel Elliot is in conference and unable to see you at the moment. But if you will report to number 2 Reserve Squadron at Brooklands this evening, you can start flying. So I did just that.
Had you been interested in flying at all before the First World War?
Well, there was one time out in Rhodesia when I picked up a notice in the paper that the Royal Naval Air Service, which was just starting, was interested in acquiring a few pilots. In those days, you had to learn to fly at your own expense, I understood, before applying to be accepted. And as I couldn't afford the journey home or by learning to fly at my own expense, I'd given up that idea. However, after about 25 minutes so-called dual and solo, I was given my ticket, sent to the Central Flying School, where I did another 15 hours on 8 different types of aeroplane. As far as I remember, I reduced 2 of them to matchwood in the process. And I was then sent to North Holt, where I reported to the adjutant, who said, "Can you fly in the dark?" I said, "Well, I can't fly in the daylight. Maybe it's easier in the dark." He said, "Well, you're the anti-Zeppelin pilot here." So I said, "Well, what did that mean?" And he told me, he said, "Well, the station supplies a pilot every odd night, and you are the permanent Zeppelin pilot on every other odd night. The two machines up in the end hangar, which you have to look after, they're your machines. Go to it." So that very night, in thick, drizzly weather, the people would think twice of before going into it in the dark, even today. The station commander, who was the duty pilot that night, went up and killed himself before he'd got 100 yards beyond the end flare. That was my introduction. And the next night it was my turn, but I had during the day flown one of the machines, which was a warp wing BE-2A, and I was told to see if I could find an army airship which was going to fly around pretending it was a Zeppelin. Well, by the most astonishing bit of good fortune, both for the airship and myself, I found it by very nearly running into it. It put its lights on in a panic when it saw me coming. I suppose that was regarded as a bit of skillful scouting navigation on my part, where, as a matter of fact, all I'd done was to fly blindly into the night and hope for the best. I managed to get down in one piece. So a few weeks later, I was promoted to flight commander, captain that is, and sent to start an anti-Zeppelin flight at Hornchurch, which was then known as Sutton's Farm, and was in fact just a green field full of sheep with a couple of tents on it. And after spending a week or two there, we went expecting the Zeppelin raids to start until the nights had got a bit longer. But I was away doing something much more dangerous than flying. I got 4 days leave to go away and get married. And Leif Robinson went up and bagged the first Zeppelin. I always say, "Bag my bird." Well, that flight got one or two Zeppelins after, but I'd left by then. And because I was sent up to Castle Bromwich to start another night flying squadron for the protection of the Midlands against Zeppelin attack. And I had to find all the aerodromes for the 3 flights and a large number of landing grounds. And I just got that squadron going, and I applied to go overseas. And I was sent overseas, but unfortunately I crashed before I got onto any operations, and was sent back to this country again. When I recovered, having been given a training flight at Y for a few weeks, which then moved up to Waddington. I again applied to go overseas, and I was posted to 45 Squadron. They had 1.5 Stratus Sopwiths, which by then was a completely obsolescent aeroplane. Slow, but it had a tail gun and a synchronized machine gun firing through the propeller. One couldn't be offensive because you couldn't catch anything. So we just flew around waiting to be shot at, which I did for, as far as I remember, 2 or 3 months. And we then, to our delight, were given some of the first camels, Clerget engine camels. And the squadron was re-equipped with them. But unfortunately, we'd only had them for about 3 weeks when the CO, who was a fine fellow, a South African called Van Rijnveld, who eventually did the first flight from England to the Cape and finished up his career as commanding general of the South African Defence Forces as a whole. He went out on one of the camels and got shot down, badly wounded. So hoping I would, sad as I was, he went, I hoped I would get the squadron, but a new group commander, I think they called him, as far as I remember, in those days, not a wing commander, no, brigade commander, which had just been appointed, and he had his own favorite boy for the job. So I didn't get it. And I was sent home again and put on to training night pilots at Marham, which I did for several months. I was then posted to a night flying camel squadron at Hainault's Farm, the east end of London, 44 Squadron. The command there, that was on anti-Zeppelin or anti-daylight raid work. But they weren't any Zeppelins and they weren't any daylight raids. But at the same time, I was raising and training a second night flying camel squadron, which was going overseas to join the only one that was already there and which I had visited to see how they worked. And I was due to take that squadron over to France, having trained them in night flying. But unfortunately, the date chosen for me to take the squadron over to France was November the 11th, 1918. So that was that.
Did all these different experiences in the First World War set you thinking at that early stage about the potential of the air weapon in a future war?
No. No, not at that stage. After that war, I was on the verge of returning to Rhodesia when my father-in-law came bouncing into my bedroom and said, they've given you a permanent commission in the Royal Air Force, in your existing rank, which I hadn't expected. But I couldn't throw it away.
Had you applied for a permanent commission?
I can't remember whether I had or not. But I was what they call a special reserve officer. And whether they gave them some preference or not, I don't know. Anyhow, I naturally enough accepted it. and spent quite a time in the an edifying task of closing down wartime airfields and cleaning up the mess generally. Then I applied to go to India, which seemed to be a source of some future fun on the frontier. And I was sent to command 31 Squadron, who are at the moment in Cawnpore, but were then sent up to Peshawar on the frontier, where we got involved in a couple of minor frontier shows.
What sort of condition did you find the squadron in when you actually got to India?
The actual condition of the squadron, from the point of view of equipment, was appalling. We couldn't get any spares. We had an awful job to keep any airplanes in the air. They were Bristol fighters, luckily enough, because they were reasonably reliable. Although the type of engine we had was long outdated, it only had a single ignition. And the disposal board in England was selling brand new dual ignition engines of the same type as scrap, but the Indian government wouldn't buy them for us. We would, for instance, indent for photographic when the army wanted us to take photographs, only to be sent packets of printing paper that had all gone brown through old age, and chemicals that would all change their nature, and so on and so forth. It was an impossible state of affairs. And I put in a pretty rude report about it, and I think that rather incensed some people out there in the army, because we were on the army vote, do you see? But anyhow, Lord Montague of Bewley went out there to investigate. I don't know why he went, but he went to investigate the complaints. And he wrote a stinking letter to the Times saying a disgraceful way the Air Force was being dealt with out there by the Army, or lack of spares, I think. And that gave Trenchard the excuse to send Sir John Salmon out to make an inquiry on the spot. Well, as I'd worked for John Salmon before, and he was also about to go to Mesopot to take over the control of Mesopotamia, or Iraq as it now is, from the army, he said, I'm going to ask for you to come over to Mesopot and I'll give you a squadron there. I was only too delighted.
What were living conditions in general like for you in India?
Oh, very good. Under the old Raj, personal conditions were fine. We had a nice bungalow with about a dozen servants. You had to pay for it all, of course. And they just, before I got there, reduced our pay considerably. But we managed to keep pretty square. We had a very fine mess. And we did plenty of tennis, or polo if you felt like it, that sort of thing, shooting. In the hot weather, you've got a couple of months up in their hill station to cool off. Oh no, the living, you lived like a blinking lord in a minor way. Except for the fact that there were no spares for the aeroplanes. And when I left that squadron I think they had the only three serviceable aeroplanes in India. And I was at the time with my headquarters flight up in Parachinar on the top end of the Gomal Pass. John Salmon arrived out there in the course of his inquiries. And as I sent him back in the squadron car, I said, I hope you realize that you have no spare tire on that car. But in any case, you have the only four good tires in the squadron. But he managed to get back all right and just took a shower.
Had the government of India tried to do anything in a hurry, as
I don't
were,
know, no.
When
I don't know, because as I say, I was posted straight to Iraq and to Baghdad. I don't know what that route is. And there, things were vastly different.
Were the operations that you were able to do in India with so few planes serviceable, were they the independent air control type of operations?
Yes, the one particular operation against the it was Alaska of tribesmen who came over the Afghan frontier, or the Durand Line as they were called, and at besieging the fort at, I forget names now, little fort up in the frontier, which was garrisoned by Kasadars, who were what you might call paid tribal militia under this immediate control of an Indian political officer. The British political officer at Tonk, where we had an advanced air base from which we worked, he was away on leave for some time, and he got heliographed messages from this Indian political officer, each message getting more and more despairing as they were besieged by these fuzzy wuzzies. And the political officer's clerk, or Babu, neat Indian fashion, solemnly piled all these messages up in proper order, waiting his master's return from leave. I don't think he even told him that there was an emergency on.